Support for the World's Podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Aleppo, past and present. This is The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. The Syrian city of Aleppo has seen nothing but war for 4 years, and today's no different.
Look, have you heard this?
Yes.
This is now a plane. It's targeting my neighborhood with machine guns.
But despite the violence and destruction, there's still a place where Syrians can celebrate Aleppo. It's a Facebook page that collects people's memories of how great the city once was.
The consistent feeling is this feeling of longing to go back and hope to go back to Aleppo at some point.
Plus, Iraqi Mandaeans in Massachusetts gather for a communal baptism.
They said, oh, it's going to be cold. I said, I don't care. I'm going to finish my meetings in Boston and I'm heading right to the water.
It's all ahead on The World. It's almost impossible for anyone who is not in Aleppo to understand what life is like in Syria's largest city right now. Aleppo has been engulfed by violence for the past 4 years, torn apart by the war between government forces and rebels. Tens of thousands have been killed there, and large parts of the city have been reduced to rubble. Half of Aleppo's pre-war population has been forced to flee. That's about 1 million displaced people. So Aleppo, the way the city was before Syria's civil war, is no more. In a few minutes, we'll hear about an online effort to preserve memories of the city. First, we turn to someone who, against all odds, is still living there. Abdul Kafi Alhamdo lives in the rebel-held eastern part of Aleppo with his wife and 7-month-old daughter. He's an English teacher, and when we reached him earlier via Skype, he said today was actually a relatively calm day.
Here in my neighborhood, there was no chilling, so we felt better today. But, you know, when it's silent, we know that there is something coming. This is our life. All the shops are empty of any kind of food. The only thing that is found in the shops is cleaning materials. That's it. When I go outside, I'm not sure that I'm going to see my wife and my daughter anymore. It's so dangerous. But what should we do? We can't just stay at home and waiting death to come. So we have to do something. Death is coming at home, at school, on the streets. It's coming. So we don't have any choice.
Abdul, yes. What do you and your wife do to lessen the stress?
We always try to forget the war, forget the killing, but just 5 minutes and directly we go back to the situation, the killing, what's going on. We wanted freedom, so we have to make many sacrifices to have a good future for our daughter and for the next generations.
What do you say to each other when you do say goodbye, when you have to leave the house?
Always she says, please keep safe. I told her, okay, I can't. It's like that. If the bomb is close to you, you die. If it's just farther, you live. She says, okay, just walk behind the walls. When you hear the plane, just go into some buildings. But she knows that I will not have time. But she says, because she's a wife, she wants to say what a woman who is afraid for her husband. And I tell her always when I go out that take care of our daughter, keep safe, don't worry. Yeah, we're trying to say these things.
What does the city look like at night?
I never now sleep for more than 2 hours, you know, continuously. I always, every hour, every half an hour, I get up. Something psychological, okay? I get up. What's up? Nothing. I get back to sleep. Sometimes, no, because of the sounds of shelling rockets, you know, I have to get up every now and then to make sure that my wife is okay, my daughter is okay. Dreams now are a problem for us sometimes. Even our dreams, rockets, bombs, siege, Iraqi militias, Assad troops, they are trying to arrest us, kill us. These things come into our dreams even. Look, have you heard this?
Yes.
This is now a plane. It's targeting my neighborhood with machine guns. Not rockets. This is only machine guns. They are powerful. They can penetrate a roof. This is always, okay? This is not, we take this for granted now.
Do you need to go somewhere to be safe?
I want to stay here. This is my land, my home. We wanted freedom. We wanted to be free people. We want to live as those people who are in the Western countries live. My father and mother told me always, keep silent, my son. Walls have got ears. I should always be afraid. I don't want for my daughter and the next generation to live in this case. We don't want them to feel as slaves. No, live as a free people or die as a free people. Yeah, the other one. I want to send a message, if you have time, for all the governments. Now it's very difficult situation for the people who are inside Aleppo. It's so difficult. In the next days, the next months, the next weeks, we don't know. We might die. We might be exterminated. Then we know that the world will shed tears. But if you don't do anything now for us, you know, don't shed the crocodile tears. If you don't do anything now for us, please keep silent forever.
Abdul Kafi Alhamdo lives in rebel-held eastern Aleppo with his wife and 7-month-old daughter. Things could get worse there soon. The Syrian government is preparing a new offensive to push the rebels out of Aleppo. That could bring even more devastation. And as I mentioned earlier, the city already looks nothing like its pre-war self, which is why some former residents created a Facebook page to try to preserve their memories of Aleppo. It's called the National Archive of Aleppo. People post old pictures of the city, but they also leave comments, mostly in Arabic. Here are a few of them as translated by our friends at the BBC.
Good morning from Aleppo.
Aleppo is the legend of the past.
I wish Aleppo a morning of love and hope, the morning of the beautiful past.
Did I not tell you that it is the most beautiful and elegant city in the world? Those were the days.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. May God rest your soul, Aleppo. I can't breathe without your air.
My BBC colleague, Lina Shekuni, has been monitoring the page. Lina, tell us about this group and this page and what it does.
So this is a Facebook page that I first noticed since 2013. The man who set it up actually had a vision that was much more than just a Facebook page. It was an initiative to preserve Aleppo's history. So uploading rare manuscripts, books, pictures of Aleppo, the old city, anything relating to the ancient history, the rich history of the city.
And hence because, that name, the National Archive of Aleppo.
Exactly. And what they do is they ask people if they can guess where these pictures are. If it's a building, they could guess what the building is, where it is. If it's a person, who the person is. And it's a kind of page to reminisce about long history of the city.
We should say that the photos are not only of buildings, they're also very personal and almost look like old family albums sometimes. They're wedding photos. There's also an amazing photo of a beauty queen from the 1950s holding her trophy cup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people discuss these personalities and the legacies. You have pictures of everything on the page, from personalities and buildings to things like pistachios, which pistachio nuts are a symbol of Aleppo, for me at least. I mean, every household had the pistachio nuts. They're raw pistachios that you can kind of, they have an outside part that you take away and then you take out the shell and you eat it. And it's something for me that just reminds me of home and Aleppo. So things like that.
Lina, how has the community around this Facebook page evolved since you first started paying attention?
The thing is, from the beginning, this page was not a political page. It's one of the few things that stayed away from divisive politics. And the consistent feeling is this feeling of longing to go back and hope to go back to Aleppo at some point. A kind of heartbreak over the city and what has happened to it.
This isn't just a news story for you, Lina. You're Syrian. You spent much of your childhood in Aleppo. What are your memories of the city?
I have so many. to me, my heart lies in Aleppo. I've always, you know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, but I've always identified as being from Aleppo. It's where the family always gathered together. It means a lot more than just a city. It's home. It's where I always thought I belonged, even though I didn't live there necessarily, but I used to go there enough to feel like this is where I fit in. And, you know, going around the streets at 7 p.m., going to cafes with my cousins, spending the day in the old souk, and then going out to the cafes around the citadel and spending the night there playing cards. You know, my grandmother's house is what brought us together every summer. And the biggest heartbreak for me was in 2012 when she passed away and we couldn't get together and unite to mourn her. We mourned my auntie, my uncle's wife, a few weeks ago. And she passed away in Qatar. And they had a house that brought us together in Aleppo. And our local mosque in Aleppo, which they frequented to go every Eid, every holiday, to go and pray there, that mosque said a prayer to her soul. People sent us the prayer on WhatsApp. So instead of being there inside the mosque, or even in Aleppo, hearing the prayer from our windows, we heard it from our WhatsApp and our smartphones. It was shared throughout the family. So it is heartbreaking not to be able to mourn and share happiness and share all these feelings in the place you call home.
What was it like to hear that prayer on WhatsApp?
It was heartbreaking. It was very hard to lose my uncle's wife because she was such a uniting figure in our family and she was loved by all of us. It was a completely other feeling, a real feeling of heartbreak to hear something that is so close to home, hearing it somewhere that's so far away from home, miles and miles away from home. It's surreal. It was the most surreal thing I've heard. It's really weird.
What's become of that house where you all used to gather?
It's my uncle's house is closed down. You know, it's locked up. It's in a part of Aleppo that's relatively safe, but no one goes there anymore. It used to be busy. You know, morning to night, the doorbell would not stop. There were always people ringing the doorbell. There were always people coming in and out of the house. And now it's just a deserted house closed down, just like many houses that have closed down because people left.
It's really extraordinary in so many ways how this war is playing out online and in social media.
Yeah. And it's in a way, social media is somehow, for some people, it's the only escape. Whether it is your daily reporting of things that you can't report on mainstream media, whether it is you're expressing hope for something, whether you're expressing pure emotions, nothing political, whether you're expressing anything, the only outlet, you know, there are some mainstream media that people go to, but I think social media has been the main tool where people have been expressing a really vast array of emotions, political views, differences, all kinds of things.
The BBC's Lina Shekuni telling us about the National Archive of Aleppo. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. It was the umbrellas that got me. That was all you could see in the photo taken from above. Thousands of umbrellas filling the streets of Warsaw, and below them, thousands of women protesting a proposal to ban abortions in Poland. All abortions, no matter the circumstances. The measure would also punish women who got an abortion and doctors who performed one with up to 5 years in jail. And guess what? It seems to have worked. Conservative leaders now say they don't support a total ban anymore and that the women's protests taught us humility. One of those Polish women who took to the streets was Magda Strzeszniak. Magda, how do you feel about the news?
Well, on one hand, I feel very positive that a social protest, which was indeed very large in size, actually worked. On the other hand, I'm not super optimistic about what the conservative government is up to. So I'm not so sure whether they will back out completely or whether they're actually planning to propose a new abortion bill, which will still kind of try to curb abortions, which are now actually Poland's abortion law is pretty restrictive already because it only allows abortions in cases of rape, incest, and danger to the mother's life or irreparable damage to the fetus. So we still have a very, very restrictive abortion right now.
Where do women in Poland get abortions if they need them?
Even if they're in this position that they actually could get a legal abortion, so they either have been raped or there is danger to their lives, very often doctors refuse to perform abortions, quoting their conscience or their Catholic faith. And then women are forced, due to lack of time, they're forced to look for other places. So there is, of course, a massive abortion underground which performs abortions illegally and often in circumstances that are very dangerous for women. Women who can afford to travel and can afford to pay for abortions often travel to neighboring countries, so to the Czech Republic, to Slovakia, or to Germany.
So presumably, from your point of view, even without this proposal to ban all abortions, there is a political fight over the right to abortion anyway.
Sure. Yes, of course.
So what is next, do you think, given that you protested, the government backed off, but it's not exactly clear what proposals will go forward?
I think the protests will go on, and I think that something has changed in the atmosphere in Poland. Something has changed in the public sphere. I've been to many demonstrations, both for women's rights and LGBT equality parades and so on. And I have never felt the sort of energy that one felt on the streets in Warsaw on Monday. There was this real sense of urgency, of anger, but also a real sense of community and sisterhood. So I think this is something that, even if the government backs off, I think this is something that won't just go away and that protests will continue and that women in Poland will fight for a more liberal abortion law.
And how do you explain that, that energy?
I think that there was a real sense that we are not being listened to and that there's a real new feeling and maybe a new social movement that has appeared over the last few weeks. We saw a lot of girls from junior high school and high school, a lot of university students, so people in their teens, or girls and women in their teens and in their early 20s, who felt that something needs to be done and that a real political goal can also be achieved.
Magda Strzeszniak in Warsaw, thank you.
Thank you so much.
The wheels of diplomacy usually turn slowly, but things have moved fast this year for the climate deal reached in Paris last December. The European Parliament has now approved the deal. That's a big step, as President Obama noted this afternoon.
Today, the world has officially crossed the threshold for the Paris Agreement to take effect. Today, the world meets the moment. And if we follow through on the commitments that this Paris Agreement embodies, history may well judge it as a turning point for our planet.
The agreement calls for countries to work together to keep the rise in global temperatures to about 1 degree Celsius beyond the warming that's already happened. The world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, is here with me. Peter, what happened to get the climate deal up and running so much faster than we expected?
Well, a couple things, Jeb. Starting with just the language of the treaty itself, originally there was a provision in there that it would go into effect January 2020. That was dropped at the last minute. Nobody really seemed to even notice it. The default now, without that, is that it goes into effect 30 days after enough countries sign on. Enough, in this case, is at least 55 countries that represent at least 55% of global carbon emissions. So with the EU signing on this week, after China and the U.S. have signed on, the biggest polluters, and a bunch of other countries have come in quickly, that threshold has been passed, and it likely will go into effect in mid-November.
So here we are in the middle of a presidential election. One candidate, Donald Trump, says had already vowed to scrap the agreement and the U.S. participation. The other candidate supports the climate agreement. But where does it going into effect actually leave us here in the United States, given that?
Well, that was, I think, also part of the calculus by Bonn. As you said, Trump has promised to repudiate the deal. He's on record saying he doesn't believe in climate change. Whatever he's said in debates, he's on record having said that. But with the U.S. having formally committed to it earlier this year, we're locked in for at least 3 years. We can refuse to participate. We can refuse to fund things. But having the agreement already in place puts sort of a brake on that exit process, if there is one.
So when it goes into effect, what you're saying is that even if Donald Trump wins the presidency, he's locked in now. So what does it actually mean for the United States?
He's locked in to a certain degree, as I said. And in terms of what it actually would require us to do, that's sort of the reality check. The Paris Agreement doesn't actually require countries to cut their emissions. What it does do is it requires them to make certain commitments to cut their emissions. It doesn't hold them to those commitments, but it requires them to make those commitments. And the idea is to create sort of a race to the top, actually, on climate change policy by having countries see what each other are doing and have them essentially try to sort of compete to have the best climate. Right.
So do you see a carbon tax in our future, cap and trade sort of thing, the kind of thing we've heard debated in the past?
Well, as I said, if Trump is elected, all bets are off. If Clinton is elected, she's promised a very aggressive climate policy, but she'll still get big pushback from the old fossil fuel industry. But the argument against a carbon tax or a cap and trade, some kind of price on carbon, is really shrinking by the day. Most of our big trading partners have already done this or committed to doing it. Europe, Japan, Mexico, even China is experimenting with a carbon tax in some places. And just this week, Canada announced that it's going to have a carbon tax by 2018. They're our biggest trading partner. So the U.S. is actually playing catch-up on this. We are behind the rest of the world when it comes to climate action, even as the problem itself is getting worse by the day.
So the pressure's on.
Yes, it is.
The World's Environment Editor, Peter Thompson, thank you.
Thanks, Jeb.
You're with The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp. 80 years ago, British fascists tried to march through a Jewish neighborhood in London. They didn't succeed.
They shall not pass, and they never passed. That's why I was proud.
Remembering the 1936 Battle of Cable Street and untangling its complicated history. That's coming up right here on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Another argument over immigration. No, I'm not talking about last night's vice presidential debate. I'm referring to what's happening in British politics this week. The ruling Conservatives are proposing new measures to reduce immigration. The party of Prime Minister Theresa May also wants to cut down on the number of foreigners working at British companies. Yesterday, Home Secretary Amber Rudd said businesses should be required to list all the non-British workers they employ. Here's Rudd speaking at the Conservative Party conference.
British businesses have driven the economic recovery in this country with employment at record levels. However, we still need to do more so all British people get the opportunities they need to get on in life. The test should ensure people coming here are filling gaps in the labour market, not taking jobs that British people could do.
Adam Biankoff is deputy editor of politics.co.uk, a political news website. Adam, give us the context of the Conservative Party conference and the kind of rhetoric that was heard this week.
The conference was dominated by discussions of what should happen following the result of the EU referendum, where it was voted to leave the EU. Mostly, that has centred on immigration. Immigration was arguably the main issue in the EU referendum campaign. And the Prime Minister, Theresa May, has suggested that she is going to take measures to bring it down quite dramatically. Last year, there was 360,000 net migration into the UK. That's a record level. And she is talking about bringing it down to the tens of thousands. So we don't really know exactly how they're going to do that, but it's going to take some quite draconian restrictions in order to bring down those numbers.
And one of the ideas caught our attention, I think because it sounds extreme, it's the idea of having companies actually have to publish how many non-British workers they have.
The message is that businesses, it's an easy option for them to bring in workers from the EU and the rest of the world rather than invest in training people in the UK. I think that's quite disingenuous given that we have almost full employment in the UK at the moment. The economy is actually doing relatively well, largely because of the high numbers of immigration that we've had. But it is a message that did resonate in the EU referendum.
How is the business community reacting?
They were quite concerned about it, and particularly the proposal to name and shame companies that employ large numbers of EU and immigrant workers. They were very concerned about that, partly because it could provide some stigma to their companies. And there are lots of companies that have got legitimate reasons to employ people from outside of the UK. And why shouldn't they? You know, I think that the danger is that this is playing into anti-immigrant fears that have risen a great deal since the EU referendum. Since the EU referendum result, there has been a big spike in hate crimes against not just immigrants, but Muslims and Jewish people as well, to an extent, have suffered a lot more hate crimes. There has been a sort of a wave of intolerance that has followed it. And the danger is that the kind of messages coming from the top of the UK government at the moment are only going to play into that. And I think that's potentially quite dangerous.
You're watching your own country and also watching the United States go through its presidential contest. Do you see the climates as analogous, this rise in anti-immigrant rhetoric?
Yes, well, I know Donald Trump has described himself as Mr. Brexit. So there is definitely a correlation there. There is certainly a growing anti-establishment feeling, and Theresa May's speech today about taking on the liberal elites and taking on the fat cats. And these are not the sort of words that we're used to hearing from a conservative politician in this country. So certainly in terms of style, there is a similarity there. And if you look across all of Europe, really, centrist parties are suffering quite a bit. It tends to be the parties on more to the extreme that are profiting at the moment in Europe. There is a chance that's going to happen. Certainly at the moment, the Conservatives seem to be moving to the authoritarian right, whereas Labour are moving very much to the left and to the hard left. Now it's a much more divided political landscape. And I think that's what you're seeing in the US as well.
Adam Bienkow, politics.co.uk, thanks very much.
Thank you.
80 years ago, the East End of London saw one of the biggest riots in the city's history. It's known as the Battle of Cable Street. Tens of thousands of Londoners clashed with police after right-wing extremists attempted to march through the heart of the city's main Jewish neighborhood. Many in the UK remember it as the day that fascism was defeated in Britain. But the truth is a lot more complicated than that, as the world's Chris Wolfe reports.
It's 1936. Across Europe, fascism is on the march. Hitler's Nazi Germany has just occupied the Rhineland, Mussolini's Italy has just conquered Ethiopia, and General Franco has just launched the Spanish Civil War. In Britain, Oswald Mosley and the British Union of Fascists, the BUF, were riding a wave of anti-Semitism.
And Sir Oswald Mosley, black shirt leader, arrives at Royal Mint Street to inspect his followers.
So when Mosley scheduled a mass march down Cable Street, the centre of London's Jewish community, the locals decided to stop him.
Communists, Labourites and Jews jammed the fascist route. Now the crowd take matters into their own hands.
I'm 99 years old and still going strong.
B.T. Orwell was in that crowd and still lives nearby.
You see, I'm Jewish, so I belong to the anti-fascist group. I was only 19 years old. I couldn't dance, so I went to all political meetings.
In a BBC documentary, she recalls the moment she got to the top of Cable Street.
and I saw all the fascists all lined up, waiting for Mosley to come there. There would have been bloodshed. If they would have gone marching, there'd have been bloodshed. There was all the dockers there. They came from everywhere.
Estimates vary, but anywhere from 20,000 to 200,000 people took part. Max Levitas, now 101, was also there.
I was a party leader, a communist, and still am. I was a runner. I knock at people's houses to get people to come into the struggle. The atmosphere was great.
What was great was that London's Jewish community for the first time saw many of their neighbours coming to their defence. Bill Fishman was another participant.
And you could hear in this conglomeration of people the chants, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, we want Mosley, dead or alive. And all across there was these banners flying. Remember them as though it were yesterday. I pushed my way through these banners. People were there, I can see them now, young and old, but mainly local people consisting of Irish and Jewish working class. They'd come there to stop the fascist invasion of our patch.
Professor Clive Bloom has written extensively on riots in London.
There was a huge threat from the BUF and Oswald Mosley, and here we have people almost, apparently at least, spontaneously rising up, defending their area. They weren't getting justice from Parliament, from the government, from the police, so they took justice into their own hands, and in this case, they won.
Some 10,000 police had been mobilised to keep order, and their first duty was to clear the streets for the fascist marchers. They stormed the people's barricades. Bill Fishman says everyone in the neighbourhood had a role in the fighting that followed.
Kids were throwing marbles at the horses and they were collapsing on the floor. There were women throwing filth and dirt and emptying garbage onto the police.
Everyone remembers those chamber pots being dumped from second-storey windows. The police were stopped. They advised Mosley to call off the march and go home, and the fascists turned and marched away. But they did not quite go into the oblivion that London folk memory insists they did. Mosley's propaganda exploited the publicity they were usually denied by the media, and his people spun the violence to portray themselves as victims. And in fact, fascist membership surged in the aftermath of the riot, even among the working class of the East End. Just a week later, a violent anti-Jewish riot took place in those same streets, an event known as the Mile End Pogrom. Clive Bloom again.
Mosley personally never turned up again directly in the East End, but his followers did. So no, they weren't defeated, but they were taught a lesson.
Most historians now agree that the Battle of Cable Street did not defeat fascism and anti-Semitism in Britain, and in fact gave them a short-term boost. They say what really defeated the fascists in Britain was their failure at the ballot box. They never became more than a fringe group. One journalist, Oliver Cam, wrote, "Mosley was a sinister and repugnant figure, all right, but his bombastic absurdity, along with the vicious sectarianism of his extremist politics, never really resonated with most British people." Whatever the historians think, locals like B.T. Orwell remain proud of the stand they took that day 80 years ago.
They shouted, "They shall not pass," and they never passed. That's why I was proud.
For The World, I'm Chris Wolfe.
Tsukiji Market in Tokyo is the largest wholesale fish market in the world. Its tuna auctions are famous. A single fish once sold for $1.8 million. But this venerable market is slated to close in a few months to make way for preparations for the 2020 Olympics. Parker Yesko has the story.
Tsukiji Market never stops. All night long, refrigerated trucks deliver fresh fish from across Japan and frozen seafood caught around the world. At dawn, Tsukiji's tuna wholesalers huddle in a chilly room and inspect what's been hauled in. Eiji Kusumoto is one of them.
People with good sense can tell the quality of the fish right away. Those without, no matter how much they look at the fish, they won't know.
Kusumoto buys 10 to 15 giant tuna each morning. He bids by silently raising his hand as the auctioneers holler prices. The tuna are loaded onto wooden carts and rolled to Kusumoto's stall on the market floor. He and his son cut the huge fish with bandsaws. They throw the heads into buckets and lay the fleshy pieces out for chefs and shopkeepers to inspect.
We display the fish so that we can see the fat content and color easily.
And if they do it well, they're sold out by 11 a.m. Kusumoto and his son are the third and fourth generation of their family to do this kind of work at Tsukiji. And they'll be the last. The market is closing.
The idea of ending Tsukiji is sad. I was raised here. I used to play in this market as a kid.
It's not the end for Kusumoto's shop, though. He and many of the other fish sellers are planning to move to a new market in Toyosu, across the river from central Tokyo. He hopes customers come too, but he's not sure they will.
There's not much public transportation to Toyosu. It's a pain for customers to get there.
Chef Naomichi Yasuda is used to riding his motorbike to Tsukiji every day. He says he'll probably follow his favorite vendors from Tsukiji to Toyosu.
I think so, but it depends. I may change. I care for the result. So this is American way. Yeah. Best result.
Yasuda ran a sushi bar in New York for 30 years before coming home to Tokyo in 2011. He remembers hearing of plans to close Tsukiji before he ever left for America.
This place, it's been a long time, and over 80 years, no renovation. When I was age 19, so that was 1979, so people talk about the fish market is moving. Oh, yeah? Takes a lot of time.
It's taken so long because everyone in Tokyo seems to have an opinion about Tsukiji. The very things that give the market so much character, like its flying fish guts and constant congestion, are what's led some to push for a more modern facility. The city eyed a move for decades before settling on Toyosu. But even in the final days of Tsukiji, there's still resistance to the new site. Here's fish seller Reiko Takahashi.
I'm strongly opposed. The soil there is bad. There's all sorts of chemicals in the ground.
The new site used to be a Tokyo gas plant, and Takahashi and her husband Kanji worry it's still toxic. The city's spent years decontaminating Toyosu, but concerns persist. Takahashi wishes they had just modernized Tsukiji.
It would be fine if they just fix some things here, but it looks like we are being moved for a highway to be put in for the Olympics. It's already been decided, so we have no choice but to go.
Tokyo's new governor, Yuriko Koike, just postponed a long-planned November opening to wait for a final environmental review of the site. It looks like the move may now happen in February. In the meantime, the fish sellers are waiting. And so is highway construction for the 2020 Olympics, which can't proceed until Tsukiji is demolished. When Tsukiji does finally close, a cluster of neighboring retail shops known as the Jogai Shijo, or Outer Market, will remain. Akiko Kawanami's family has operated a shop next to Tsukiji for 80 years. She worries about the decrease in foot traffic.
I was raised in this building. I woke up into the hustle and bustle of the market. The little Tsukiji carts that run around making that noise. And the bells on all the bikes were annoyingly loud. I've never had a quiet morning.
And she isn't hoping for one anytime soon. For the world, Parker Yesko, Tsukiji Market, Tokyo.
I'm Jeb Sharp with The World. Most of the people who've left the Middle East in recent years and resettled here in the U.S. are Muslims, but not all of them. Right here in Massachusetts, for example, there's a community of Mandaeans. They're mostly from Iraq, and the religion they practice isn't familiar to many people. From the city of Worcester, here's The World's Matthew Bell.
On a recent Sunday morning, several dozen people wrapped in flowing white cotton robes line up on the shoreline of Lake Quinsigamond. They're here to be baptized. For the Mandaeans, John the Baptist holds great importance. So do some of the other biblical prophets like Adam and Noah. But Mandaeans are not Christians or Jews. The man presiding over this day-long ritual is a high-ranking priest, Sheikh Salah. He lives in Australia and flew in for the weekend. Salah's big beard, sandals, and robes make for a very old-world look, except for the dark sunglasses he wears throughout the proceedings. The prayers that Salah is chanting are a mix of Arabic and Aramaic, the same language spoken by Jesus. It's spoken by very few people in this day and age. In fact, there are only about 60,000 Mandaeans around the world today. Worcester has become a fast-growing community. Around 2,500 Mandaeans, most of them born in Iraq, have settled in the area in the last 15 or so years. They're trying to keep their faith alive, and communal baptisms are a big part of that.
We believe in multiple baptizations, so we baptize when we're born, before marriage, after marriage, and also in between a lot. So it is just really great feeling.
Noor Rumi is a physician who's been baptized many times over the years. She's not really praying for anything specific on this morning, but Rumi says she's absolutely delighted to be here.
Such a comfort and purify feeling. You feel that you are in a different place. You feel that you are near God. It is a holy thing inside you. It gives you energy to keep on. So it's a beautiful feeling.
Rumi is here with her 27-year-old daughter, Rend Nashi, who's also a doctor. Unlike the older generation, she says she's not a super religious person, but being here and getting baptized for the first time since she was a kid is important.
There's sort of a juxtaposition of sorts. You see people clothed in white and performing these ancient ceremonies that are 2,000 years old right next to a highway. And it's interesting because you look around and it gives you this very surreal feeling that this is the same way that Jesus was baptized 2,000 years ago.
Like Judaism and Islam, the Mandaean religion has lots of rules about diet. For those who want to be strict, that means no alcohol and no meat. It's a closed religion, meaning there's no way to convert. Mandaeans are also pacifists. Their teachings prohibit the use of violent force, even for self-defense. Nonetheless, Mandaeans were able to preserve their distinct religious tradition for centuries in the heart of the rough-and-tumble Middle East. And there are a few reasons for that.
One is that from the start, Islam was not so keen necessarily to spread.
Gerard Russell is the author of a book about the disappearing religions of the Middle East called Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms.
The Muslim Arabs wanted an empire, but they didn't necessarily want everybody to adopt their religion. So contrary to sort of expectations, I think, there was always a constituency for tolerance.
But over time, the Mandaeans faced periodic waves of repression and violence that continued into the 20th century and under the rule of Saddam Hussein. And things got really bad after the 2003 U.S. invasion, when most Iraqi Mandaeans fled for their lives. Sinan Abdullah is a 70-year-old dentist from a prominent Mandaean family. When I ask him about life in America for the community, he says he loves this country, and he sees it as a true land of opportunity. But he adds that prejudice and bigotry can be a problem. It's ironic, he says, because the Mandaeans have historically suffered at the hands of fanatic Muslims. But here in the U.S., Abdullah says sometimes they get caught up in the anti-Muslim attitude expressed by some Americans.
They look at you and he looks like them. He doesn't wear clothes like us, and he eats with his fingers. Therefore, he's a terrorist.
So you feel that sometimes?
From both sides. The Muslim will come to me to have their tooth extracted, and they tell me, you're a Muslim? I'm like, no. Then I won't tell you, salam alaikum. I said, fine. If peace is only for you, keep it. That's your kind of peace.
One of the people who's been a driving force for the Mandaean community in Worcester is Wissam Briji, a medical device specialist from Baghdad. He's trying to raise funds to build a Mandaean temple in the Worcester area. He says that's the best way to preserve the faith. And in the meantime, he never misses a chance to be baptized by someone like the high priest visiting today.
That's amazing for me, just to be here. That's why they said, oh, it's going to be cold. I said, I don't care. I'm going to finish my meetings in Boston, and I'm heading right to the water.
For The World, Matthew Bell, Worcester, Massachusetts.
We're going to end today's program on a musical note. It comes courtesy of Harold Lopez Nusa. He's a pianist and composer from Havana, Cuba. The 33-year-old stopped by our studios today to play us a track from his debut American release, El Viaje, or The Journey.
I compose this particular song, El Viaje, in one of my travels. Musicians, we travel a lot around the world. You learn a lot from other cultures. You meet new people. And this is something very special for my background. When I play this song outside my country, outside Cuba, I always think in Cuba. And when I play El Viaje in Cuba, I always think in myself traveling all around the world. So it's something that could make me travel a lot. The song that you just listened to is called El Viaje. It's my first American release, so I hope that you enjoy it.
Cuban pianist and composer Harold Lopez Nusa brings our journey and show to a close today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Jeb Sharp. Thanks for being with us.
PRI, Public Radio International.